for many years, for decades, they published in their journals, such as the Journal of Law and Economics, Journal of Political Economy, and other academic journals, critiques of antitrust regulation in practice, but they always held on to the position that there was, at some point in the late 19th century, a golden age of antitrust where it was necessary to have antitrust laws to rein in monopoly. And I'm also going to talk about why that is a myth. There never was a golden age of antitrust. And so when the first American antitrust law was passed at the federal level in 1890, the Sherman antitrust law, there were several dozen states had passed state antitrust laws before that. And I'll get to that a little later in the lecture. But so we're talking about 1890. And one oddity about this was that this was a period of price deflation that had been occurring already for about 25 years at that point. So there was a general price deflation. And by that point, it was still pretty well understood that what monopolies do is to raise prices. That of course, is the mainstream view in economics, and that was understood back then in 1890. And so it always was sort of odd that here you had this big crusade to do something about the trust that were supposedly monopolies, but at the same time, you had a 25-year decline in prices. And not only that, I'm going to read off some statistics in a little bit, that the very companies that were accused of being monopolies had a long record of dropping prices and expanding production, creating new products for years and years prior to the Sherman Act. And it's very odd that I think that I probably was in 1985 the first economist to actually write an article, publish an article in Economics Journal, the one I put on the reading list, that challenged this whole view that there was a rampant monopoly in the 1890s based on some plain historical facts. But when after the antitrust law was passed in 1890, named after Senator John Sherman of Ohio, they didn't really enforce it much. Congress didn't know what to do with it for quite a while. It wasn't until the turn of the century. It took another 10 to 15 years before they began filing some lawsuits from the federal government under the antitrust laws. And one of the earlier ones was a 1908 lawsuit against the American Tobacco Company. And the American Tobacco Company was found guilty of violating the Sherman antitrust law, which outlawed, the language of it is, conspiracies and restraint of trade. And here's what a circuit court said in finding the American Tobacco Company guilty of violating the Sherman Act, that the record in this case does not indicate that there has been any increases in the price of tobacco to the consumer. So they came right out and said that. There was no evidence of unfair competition or improper practices. And they also said the volume of output of tobacco products had, quote, enormously increased. And so that's what they said. I mean, by all the standards of mainstream economics, they've been cutting their prices, increasing production, creating new products. That was all admitted by the court, but they gained a big market share. It gained a big market share. And that's what they were convicted of, gaining a big market share. And the economists of the day, of course, most of them were very skeptical and critical of this, because it was quite obvious that this, what American Tobacco Company was doing, was becoming more and more efficient than all of its competitors. And when it was found guilty of violating the Sherman Act, there were literally thousands of competitors in the industry. For example, the cigar industry alone had more than 20,000 manufacturing plants in the year 1910. But American Tobacco Company was the most successful. And of course, in a free market with thousands of competitors, the only way you can be the most successful is to have the best quality and or lowest prices of the product. That's the only way. There's no way you could coerce or force anybody to buy your products to make you the most successful company. So they're broken up for being successful, essentially. And of course, in terms of harm to the consumer, the price of most tobacco products was falling. A few statistics, price of cigarettes fell from $2.77 in 1895 to $2.20 in 1907, the year before the circuit court found the company guilty of monopolizing the tobacco industry. Cigars sold for $4.60 per thousand in 1895 and $3.60 by 1907, the year before they were found guilty. And so the effect of dominance by the American Tobacco Company on this industry was to push prices down to the benefit of the consumers. And so that was one of the very first cases prosecuted by the U.S. government. And what it did was to protect competitors from competition by punishing the most successful, the most vigorously price-cutting and cost-cutting and output-expanding company in the whole industry. And then after that, another classic case was in 1937, and there were some in between here, of course, but we don't have all night to talk about all the famous antitrust cases. The greatest book on this is Antitrust and Monopoly, Anatomy of a Policy Failure by Dominic Armentano. It's indispensable if you want to study the history of American antitrust, at least up until the 1980s. It's a real classic, and Armentano is in Austria. But in 1937 came the Alcoa case, the Aluminum Company of America, and it was also found guilty of violating the antitrust laws. And because it did dominate the aluminum market. And it had a lot of competition. It had competition from the Ford family, Ford Motor Company. They tried to get into the aluminum business. J.B. Duke, the founder of the American Tobacco Company, he invested in aluminum. And so they had quite a bit of stiff competition. And I thought I'd mention this particular case, Alcoa, because the judge in the case was Judge Learned Hand, L-E-A-R-N-E-D. I'm not making up that name, Judge Learned Hand. Good name for a judge, I suppose. But this was one of the most ridiculous statements on economic subjects ever made by a government judge. Here's Judge Learned Hand condemning Alcoa and finding them guilty of violating the Sherman Act for what? For, quote, I'm quoting the judge, superior skill, foresight, and industry. All of this superior skill, foresight, and industry was exclusionary. And who were they excluding? Well, they were excluding the higher priced companies in the industry. That's who they were excluding. He condemned Alcoa for engaging in so much advertising, because advertising stimulated sales, and then what did it do after it stimulated sales of advertising? It, quote, efficiently supplied a demand that had evolved. So he condemned it for being efficient. And he said this is another condemnation. Alcoa, quote, doubled and redoubled its capacity to fill the consumer demand, and it embraced every new opportunity with a great organization manned with elite business personnel, end quote. And so Judge Learned Hand condemned Alcoa for being a great organization with the elite business personnel in the market. And because it was doing that, and it had such low prices compared to everyone else, it was excluding higher priced competitors. And so these two cases illustrate exactly what antitrust was about once it began, the government began enforcing it. It became a protectionist tool to protect competitors from competition, not to protect consumers from monopoly. And some other cases, I'll just mention a few other cases proceeding through history. One other case that antitrust economists know a lot about is the Brown Shoe Company case of 1956, where Brown Shoe Company merged with Kinney Shoes, K-I-N-N-E-Y shoes. And the end result was only, as I can recall, just a few percentage points in market share, but this was somehow supposed to be alarming there. And here we have, in this case, by 1962, The decision came down to the United States Supreme Court, and Chief Justice Earl Warren made the statement that the cost reductions and product improvements caused by this merger would enable the combined companies, I'm quoting him now, to market their own brands at prices below those of competing independent retailers. And that's a bad thing. And so there were these two companies that merged, and the worry by the government was that there would be a synergy by the two merged companies that would lead to economic efficiency that would allow them to cut their prices to consumers, and that would be bad for the competitors, they said. Of course, in the way competition works, the competitors would have been forced to find a way to cut their prices too. And maybe they're not even forced, but it might have been very convenient for them to do so and not a big struggle because they were forced, had to do so because of competition. And so here's another statement by Earl Warren. He says, well, Congress, in creating the Sherman Act, quote, wanted to promote competition through protection of viable, small, locally owned businesses. So there you have it. You have the Chief Justice of the United States, Earl Warren, saying that in his opinion, the purpose of antitrust was to protect smaller competitors from competition. And of course, the reason, the main reason they are smaller is that they're not as good. Their products are not as good and they're not as low priced. That's why they're smaller. There's nothing inherent about any of these companies that made them small forever. If they would do a better job in pleasing the consumers, they would have become big, like Alcoa and like these other companies became, like Brown Shoe Company and Kinney, the new company. And so, and of course, there are many other examples. I'll give you a few more to impress upon you how this has played out over the years. In 1962, the government forced the Schwinn Bicycle Company, a famous American bicycle company, to separate itself from its network of dealers. And so it had its own dealers that sold the bicycles, the manufacturing company did. And the government said, that's not good. You have to let other companies sell your bicycles. And because this gives you an advantage over your competition. Well, of course, that's the whole purpose of competing in business, to have an advantage over the competition. And foreign competitors eventually drove Schwinn into bankruptcy because this was an efficient arrangement for them. It worked well. It helped them sell bicycles. They eventually went bankrupt. During the 1950s, the federal antitrust regulators prohibited RCA from charging royalties to American licensees for distributing its products, its electronics products, radios primarily. And so what did RCA do? It licensed its products to Japanese companies in the 1950s. And that gave rise to the whole Japanese microelectronics industry, which eventually eclipsed companies like RCA. Antitrust regulation destroyed Pan American Airlines in the United States because Pan American Airlines had a business of flying overseas, mostly to Europe, and it did not have a system of feeder routes from the United States to flew from New York to London, but you would have to fly on another airline from say Chicago to New York to get the overseas flight. Pan Am wanted to have its own system of domestic flights to feed into its points of departure to Europe. The government said no, that would be you would become too successful if you did that. Pan Am went bankrupt. There's another famous example would be General Motors. They were never prosecuted under the antitrust laws, but its official policy, company policy from 1937 until 1956, was to never let its market share top 45% of the domestic market for automobiles for fear of an antitrust lawsuit. So not only did the government over all these years engage in many, many lawsuits against companies for being efficient, thereby harming economic efficiency, harming the competitiveness and productivity of American industry, but it sent a signal to many other companies that weren't sued that you should not compete too strongly. Don't compete too vigorously, or else if you're too successful, you will probably be the victim of a government antitrust lawsuit. And so that's the system that we developed. And Dominic Armentano has a great summarizing point that he makes about all of this. In his book, by the way, Antitrust and Monopoly, it's much larger than the one I have on the syllabus. It takes a look at the 55 of the most famous and most widely discussed federal antitrust cases up until the early 1980s, which is when the book was first published. And I recommend it to everyone. But here's what he says about after this entire book has been written. He concludes that antitrust policy in America is a misleading myth that has served to draw public attention away from the actual process of monopolization that has been occurring throughout the economy. The general public has been deluded into believing that monopoly is a free market problem and that the government, through antitrust enforcement, is on the side of the angels. The facts are exactly the opposite. Antitrust served as a convenient cover for an insidious process of monopolization in the marketplace. And I would add that there's no reason to believe that this is not also true of antitrust regulation in every other country that has antitrust regulation because of the inherent character of all this. Of course, you know, another famous antitrust case, of course, would be the Standard Oil of Ohio. This was John D. Rockefeller's company, which was broken up in 1911. And just a few salient facts about this was that Rockefeller, basically the bottom line of what Rockefeller did was to reduce the price of his products more sharply than all his competitors did for decades at a time. And he was never accused by the government of predatory pricing, by the way. That's sort of the fairy tale that you can achieve a monopoly by pricing below cost, losing money on purpose to drive everyone out of the market, and then once they're gone, charging a monopolistic price. You don't do that by dropping your price for 40 years, which John D. Rockefeller did. And so, for example, the price of refined oil went from 30 cents in 1869 to 10 cents in 1874 to 8 cents in 1885. And that's when he started to get in trouble with the government. That's when the government started looking at him as some sort of potential monopolist because he was driving the price down for decades of refined petroleum. And eventually he was convicted of that. His company was broken up into different pieces, even though at the time he had more than 300 competitors. And so that's how it works. And now, the next point I want to make about this is that, as I said, this was cataloged. This failure of antitrust to protect consumers was cataloged for decades by mostly Chicago school scholars in places like the Journal of Law and Economics, the Journal of Political Economy, the Journal of Legal Studies, and various other places. Books had been written. Robert Bork, the American jurist who taught at law school, at Yale Law School for many years, and was nominated to the Supreme Court in the 1980s. I didn't make it, but he was nominated. He was the American Solicitor General for a while in the Nixon administration. And that's the lawyer for the government that argues before the Supreme Court. And he wrote that he was a Chicago school lawyer. He was trained at the University of Chicago. And so when he was educated, it was in the middle of the development of all these critiques of antitrust came about through the Chicago journals. And he wrote a famous book called The Antitrust Paradox that was used very widely in university courses. So that was a classic Chicago school statement of this. Another classic Chicago school book is Concentration, Mergers, and Public Policy by Yale Brozen. B-R-O-Z-E-N is how he spells the name. And then Richard Posner, the judge Richard Posner, who recently wrote an absolutely horrible book claiming capitalism is the failure of capitalism is the cause of the current economic crisis. But he also wrote a book on antitrust law some 30 years ago that contained a lot of the Chicago school critiques of antitrust regulation. However, the standard approach by even the Chicago schoolers, which were really considered to be the radical free market people by the rest of the economics profession, was to say that yes, antitrust has gone astray, but at the beginning in 1890, there was a rampant monopolization, and there was therefore a reason for antitrust. There was a golden age of antitrust, and that was stated by the late George Stigler, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics, famous Chicago School economist. It was stated by Posner himself. Here's some quotes that I have. Richard Posner of himself said that the Sherman Act, I'm quoting, the Sherman Act was passed in 1890 against a background of rampant cartelization and monopolization of the American economy. George Stigler, another Chicago School, quote, free market economist, said, the Sherman Act was, quote, a public interest law in the same sense that laws enforcing private property and contracts or suppressing crime are public interest laws. There's another textbook author named Marshall Howard, who wrote a book on antitrust economics, who described the Sherman Antitrust Act as, quote, the Magna Carta of free enterprise. And so there's this disconnect here, this theoretical disconnect, where you have Chicago School scholars documenting 100 years of failure of antitrust to protect consumers from monopoly, 100 years. But they're still saying at the same time, but there was maybe 1 or 2 years there where it was a good idea. And of course, some years ago, I smelled a very big rat over all of this and thought, well, this doesn't make any sense. surely there must be something inherent about this. And of course, I knew I'd read Murray Rothbard and other Austrians who made the case that, there is an inherent conflict between competition and antitrust regulation. And so one of the things I did was I searched all the literature I could. I had a research assistant, and I had him go to the library and get all the books they had at the George Mason Library at the time on antitrust and find out, you know, has anybody documented the mainstream definition of monopoly, not even the Austrian definition, but the mainstream definition of monopoly as restricting output and raising prices. Is that documented that during this era, 1890, the decade before the Sherman Act, that there was output restrictions and price increases? Because this was a period of price deflation back then. And what we found was not a single published book on the topic had any data. It was just asserted. These assertions that were made, the quotes I just read by Stigler and Posner and others, were just asserted out of thin air without any documentation whatsoever, which was also very odd for the Chicago School, which always prided itself so much on empiricism, on empirical testing and use of statistics and so forth, hypothesis testing. But here they have, it's based on religion. Here. And so, I started looking into this, and one of the things I ran across, this was sort of an investigative research project on my part. I ran across kind of an interesting PhD dissertation by a man named Sanford Gordon, who surveyed public attitudes toward the trusts prior to 1890. And here's one interesting quote from Sanford Gordon. It was an article that was published in the Southern Economic Journal in 1964. He said, perhaps the most violent reaction against the industrial combinations or trusts of any single special interest group came from farmers. They singled out the jute bagging and alleged binder twine trust and sent petitions to both their state legislators and to Congress demanding relief. Cotton was suggested as a good substitute for jute to cover the cotton bales. So I found that, and keep in mind, what he's saying is that there is jute that is a substitute for cotton in the agriculture industry, and jute was falling in price, and the cotton farmers did not like this. They did not like the fact that these competing products was falling in price pretty severely. And so they ran to government and asked government to do something about the falling price of the product that competes with their product. And so that was a pretty good smoking gun to me, that what was behind the impetus behind the passage of this law was plain old-fashioned special interest politics. And it certainly is consistent with how the antitrust laws were applied for over 100 years in light of all those examples I just read off of some of the court cases where companies were prosecuted for being efficient. Okay, and so one of the things I did, and this is the article that I'm talking about, is my article on the reading list that was in the International Review of Law and Economics way back in 1985, The Origins of Antitrust. I had a research assistant run through the congressional record, 1889 and 1890, and take a list of all the companies and industries that were accused of being monopolies. And so once we did that, there are historical statistics. There's a publication called Historical Statistics of the United States. It's published by the U.S. Census Bureau. It's what economists use when they do historical research on things. It's one of the main sources of statistics. And there were a good many statistics that provided production levels and prices of these very industries that were being accused of being monopolies. And basically what I found was that this was a period of deflation, the decade before the Sherman Act, 1880 to 1890. It was a period of deflation, and the actual price deflation was about 24%. This was a period of what you would call good deflation, because it was caused by a very rapid increase in supply in the markets. Okay, not by a depression, but by production. Okay, so the price deflation was about 24%, you know, on average from 1880 to 1890. But in these industries that were being, I got the wrong statistic. I love price deflation. Output expansion. I'm reading the wrong statistic off the table here. Let's look at output first. Output expanded GDP by about 24%. I read the wrong column here. From 1880 to 1890. In the economy as a whole. So about almost 25% quarter increase in the U.S. economy, size of the U.S. economy. Those industries that were supposedly restricting output and were being accused of being monopolies increased production during that same period by 175% on average. Okay, so several times faster than the economy as a whole. So I established that these industries that were being accused of being monopolies were growing several times faster than the economy as a whole. And as for prices, the same thing. You saw the consumer price index from 1880 to 1890 fell by about 7%. But then the prices of some of these products of the so-called trusts fell much more dramatically. For example, steel rails were accused of being monopolized. Price of steel rails fell by 53% compared to 7% of the CPI during that time. Refined sugar fell by 22%, lead 12%, zinc 20%, and so forth. And I also found that members of Congress who were supporting the Sherman Antitrust Act recognized this. They clearly recognized this, and they said it. I quote one congressman as saying this: the trusts have made products cheaper. They reduce prices. But if the price of oil, for instance, were reduced to 1 cent a barrel, he's talking about John D. Rockefeller, it would not right the wrong done to the people of this country by the trusts which have destroyed legitimate competition and driven honest men from legitimate business enterprises, end quote. The member of Congress named Mason, who supported the Sherman Act. And so it was clearly recognized at the time that the effect of the trust was rapid expansion, the creation of new products, and dropping prices. And the reason they wanted an antitrust law was to put an end to that, to cause higher prices, slow down the expansion of production, slow down the creation of new and better products for the consumers, because the losers in American business either could not or would not keep up. So this was always a protectionist law from the very beginning, is the argument that I make. Another thing I did in my research project was I wanted to know what the popular press was saying about all this at the time. It's one thing to just look at these statistics guided by your knowledge of economics, But I thought it would be interesting to see what the New York Times and other papers like that were saying about the trust, because I'd read these statements from the textbooks by Stigler and Posner and so forth about how horrible it supposedly was. But what were they actually saying? What were the people actually talking about at the time? Let's not take Stigler's word for it or Judge Posner's word for it. And so I had the same research assistant go through on microfilm months and months of the New York Times to see what they were saying about the Sherman Act at the time it passed. And he uncovered some interesting things. One of the things that I knew was that during the same year, the Sherman Act was passed in June. In October, the McKinley Tariff was passed, and that was, at the time, the biggest tariff increase in American history at one time. So here are the same people, and the exact same people. The sponsor in the United States Senate of the McKinley Tariff was Senator John Sherman. And so in June, he sponsors the Sherman Antitrust Act that is supposedly going to protect consumers from monopoly. Then a few months later, he sponsors the biggest tariff increase in American history, which at the time, everyone knew is not in the interest of consumers. Adam Smith's teachings were already widely known in America 50 years before this. And so it was not as though there was misunderstanding about the effects on consumers of high tariffs. This was understood by anybody. And so the New York Times looked at this, and the New York Times was originally in favor of the Sherman Antitrust Act, and then it switched its editorial position to oppose the Sherman Act. And here's what it said. In October 1st, 1890, it said, the New York Times wrote that so-called antitrust law was passed to deceive the people and to clear the way for the enactment of this law relating to the tariff. It was projected in order that the party organs, meaning the Republican Party organs, that's who was in control of the whole government here, might say to the opponents of tariff extortion and protected combinations, behold, exclamation mark, they write, we have attacked the trusts. The Republican Party is the enemy of all such rings. So what the New York Times is saying is that the Republican Party was conniving to increase tariffs tremendously, which everyone knows is bad for consumers, but they did not want to take the blame for harming consumers, and so they tried to shift the blame to the big bad trust, John D. Rockefeller, Cornelius Vanderbilt, all the so-called robber barons. They were supposed to take the heat, take the blame for the higher prices that would come as a result of the tariff increases on those industries that benefited from the big tariff increases. And so the New York Times position was that the Sherman Antitrust Law was a big political fig leaf, or maybe a better word would be a political cloud designed to fog the perception of the American public over what was really going on here and what was the real source of the higher prices, namely the tariff. Government, in other words. Government is a source of monopoly, not the free market. And the New York Times referred to the McKinley Tariff Bill, by the way, as the campaign contributors tariff bill, which, you know, these corporations that benefit from it, of course, they shower the Republican Party with campaign contributions to finance the political careers of these characters. And so the Times perfectly understood what was going on. And I think the New York Times had it right, that was the purpose of the Sherman Antitrust Law, so that it always was from the very beginning a protectionist scam, and so that it is not at all a paradox or a surprising event that we had for the next 100 years and more, case after case after case of antitrust laws actually harming competition and not protecting competition. They were never intended to protect competition, as far as that's concerned. Another thing I did along the lines of this research was, since I knew that several dozen states actually, had passed antitrust laws prior to the Sherman Act, a co-author and I published another article that was in a Review of Austrian Economics some years ago. And I guess I could look up the reference here and give it to you. very quickly. I should have done this earlier. Well, there's one. Well, anyway, you can find it. If you find the Review of Austrian Economics, you can just look up my name and you'll find the article. But it's about the state antitrust laws, and some of the origins. We did a case study of the state of Missouri, which had one of the first antitrust laws, and it was mostly farmers in Missouri that got their senator, either United States senator, his name was Vest, Senator George Vest, to establish a commission, a government commission, to look into the problem, as they saw it, of declining beef prices. And the meatpacking industry had been developed. There were these so-called big four companies in operating mostly out of Chicago, Illinois. They figured out, they centralized the meatpacking industry in Chicago, which was at the time had become a very big railroad hub. And then in refrigerated rail cars, which at the beginning was mostly train cars with the doors open in the wintertime, they would ship dressed beef already cut up into steaks and so forth, all out into the hinterlands. And so all of a sudden, the farmers who had been enjoying selling their beef at monopolistic prices in all the little mom and pop shops in St. Louis and Evanston, Illinois, and all these other, all these little towns, big towns, all throughout the Midwest and elsewhere, all of a sudden there was competition with lower priced beef. And this was alarming. Something must be done about this. And so, here's one statistic. Beef prices were 38% lower by 1890 than they were in 1884. They also were complaining about the price of pork going down. The price of hogs had fallen 19%. And also, the farmers in Missouri were complaining that wheat prices were going down. Wheat was about 35% lower than it was a decade earlier. And this is the late 1880s. And so all of the complaints, all about the trusts, the wheat trust, the beef trust, the hog trust, that they were complaining about in Missouri anyway, was all based on the fact that entrepreneurs had figured out how to get these products through some kind of centralized distribution process and get them to market more cheaply than they were doing, and they didn't like that. So they ran to government to do something about that, and they ended up getting the state of Missouri to pass a state antitrust law that was aimed to do something about the declining prices of all these products, these agricultural products. And the farm lobby was very, very influential at the time. For example, if you were a state legislator in the state of Missouri in those days, if you happen to be a dentist by profession, you would identify yourself as a farmer-dentist. If you happen to be a school teacher and you're in the state legislature, you would identify yourself as a farmer/teacher because there were so many farmers and they were so influential with regard to voting that you had to attach yourself to the farmers. And so that was the true origins of antitrust. Was the farm movement in America complaining against declining prices. And then by the time you get to 1890, they were joined by certain manufacturers who were complaining about declining prices of these super efficient companies like John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company. Even in the case of Standard Oil, Rockefeller's biggest critic was one of the famous muckraking journalists, as they were called. Her name was Ida Tarbell, and she wrote a whole book called A History of the Standard Oil Company. And here's what she called Standard Oil, which she was condemning. She called it, quote, a marvelous example of economy, not only in materials, but in time and footsteps. she said that every movement in the whole company's operations was a marvel of efficiency. And of course, that's why Standard Oil was so successful. It was a marvel of efficiency. And therefore, she wrote a whole book condemning Standard Oil, which I suppose she hoped would help encourage the government to crack down on Standard Oil. And Ida Tarbell was the sister of the treasurer of a competing company called the Pure Oil Company, which Standard Oil had driven out of business. And so she had a personal axe to grind against Rockefeller. And even though she honestly admitted that his company was marvelously efficient, and recall that I read from the decision by Judge Learned Hand about Alcoa, he said the same thing about Alcoa. He didn't use the word marvelously, but marvelously efficient, therefore you're guilty of violating the Sherman Act. And so, the moral to the story for this evening is that in terms of antitrust in practice, you could find some exceptions that prove the rule of antitrust cases that don't seem to have been as horrible as the ones I've mentioned, but those are exceptions that prove the rule. Armin Tando's book, Antitrust and Monopoly, proves that. 55 of the most widely cited and studied cases, he concluded that in every single instance, the companies, 55 cases, the companies that were sued by the government were either dropping prices precipitously, expanding production, creating new products, becoming more competitive, advertising more vigorously, doing all the things that the most vigorous competitors in any industry would do. Every single case, in no instance in these 55 cases, did Dominic Armentano find that these companies were raising their prices or harming consumers. It really is amazing that all of this was swept aside by the government courts over all these years. And the even more amazing thing is that most of the economics profession to this day still supports antitrust regulation. The most charitable thing you can say about it is that they're ignorant of the effects of antitrust regulation. Or if they're not, they have this sort of pie-in-the-sky attitude that, well, yes, we've made mistakes for 120 years, but maybe we can fix things with smart guys like me in charge. That is essentially, I think, the main reason why the Chicago School people, such as Richard Posner and George Stigler, took this position that they took. I think they always believed that, well, yes, a century of government failure here to protect consumers is true. That's the true history. But if you just put some smart people like us Chicago School economists in charge of antitrust, we can change things around. Politics doesn't usually work that way, though. One of the reasons why these cases are all put together the way they are, I guess somebody found my journal article. One of the reasons these cases are put together the way they are is, as I've mentioned, these companies who don't want to compete, they run to their congressman or their senator, and members of Congress or the Senate will pressure the Federal Trade Commission or the Antitrust Division of the U.S. Justice Department to prosecute the efficient company, the company that's cutting prices, expanding production, inventing new products, and so forth. And so they will only listen to the advice of economists if it is in their political self-interest to listen to the advice of economists. Just like it's the same situation with macroeconomics and monetary policy, politicians are only going to listen to the advice of economists if they think it's good for their career. And if economists tell them, oh, don't protect the company in your district that employs 10,000 people from competition from a superior competitor because economic theory says you shouldn't do that, they're going to do that. If that company gives them $1 million for their campaign, re-election campaign, they're going to do it. They're not going to listen to the economics profession. So it doesn't really matter what the economics profession says about that. An analogy I once made at a conference when I made a talk on this was there's something in the southern United States. If anyone of you ever traveled to Auburn University, usually you fly into Atlanta, Georgia, and then there's about an hour and a half drive to Auburn University, to the Mises Institute. And all along the way, it's Interstate 85. And all along the way, you see there are these gigantic growths of these bushes or vines. Some of them that they overwhelm giant pine trees that are 100 foot in the air, and they strangle the pine trees and even break the trunks of the pine trees. And this vine is called kudzu, K-U-D-Z-U. It was imported into the United States in the 1930s during the so-called Dust Bowl from Japan, because it was thought, because they have such deep roots that they're almost impossible to kill. You have to pull them out by the roots. But anyway, at an antitrust conference, I was arguing that the only sensible approach to antitrust is to be an abolitionist rather than a reformer, because reforming antitrust is about as successful as clipping kudzu rather than pulling it out by the roots and then burning the roots, which needs to be done with kudzu to get rid of it. You can't just trim it. You can't just trim it around the edges with hedge clippers. That's not going to work. It grows too fast, and it takes over entire mountainsides, as it has all throughout the South primarily. And so that's why a lot of the Austrians, like myself, are antitrust abolitionists. But the difference between us and the typical Chicago school economist was that the Chicago schoolers believe in antitrust reform rather than abolition, which is also kind of an anomaly, because a lot of the Chicago school economists are well known for publishing in the area of political economy or public choice, how governments operate. And you'd think they would know better, that it is not going to succeed. But they typically don't. And so I'm not going to speculate anymore on their motives for doing this, but that is a distinguishing feature of the difference between the Chicago school approach to antitrust and the Austrian school approach, which looks at it more or less as inherently incompatible with competition. And so I guess that's about what I wanted to say for tonight, in addition to giving you some pretty interesting literature, I think, to read. And so if you have some questions, feel free to write up the questions here, and I'll sit around and do my best to answer them if you have some. Stephen Davis just ordered Armentano's book. Very good. Congratulations. It's a great book, Antitrust and Monopoly, Anatomy of a Policy Failure. It's too bad Dominic Armentano retired so young. I think he was still in his 50s when he retired some years ago. Good for him. He left cold and liberal Connecticut for Florida, but I wish it would have been great if he had kept doing more research like this. Let's see. Here's the Ida Tarbell book, The History of the Standard Oil Company. I guess it's online. That's pretty interesting. There are a lot of classic books in the area. There's an old classic by a legal scholar, is William Letwin, who was pretty good. He was a Chicago school lawyer, but he was better than most. That's another old classic. That was probably a 40-year-old book on the Sherman Act, as far as that goes. Another economist who's published some good things on this is Thomas Hazlett, H-A-Z-L-E-T-T. Not spelled the same as Henry Hazlett. And his dissertation at UCLA, I don't know, 25 years ago, something like that, was on the Sherman Act. So if you wanted to dig around for academic literature along these lines, there's another economist that's a pretty good Chicago school economist that sort of came around to the Austrian view, is George Bittlingmeyer. And he has co-authored some things with Hazlett on the issue. So if you want to do a literature search in the academic literature, George Bittlingmeyer is a pretty good name to look up as well, as well as our journals, the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics and the Review of Austrian Economics. There have been quite a few antitrust-related articles by myself and plenty of others in there. Yeah, How Capitalism Saved America. Everybody in the country should be required to read that book. Let's see. Craig is asking, Do you think that as the effects of inflation are felt by more people, that monopolies will be blamed for the rising prices? That's usually is what happens. Politicians always try to blame some companies for raising the prices, even though it's the Fed that is the cause of the raising of higher prices. And so, wherever the next bubble is, people were so busy thinking they were becoming wealthy through rising real estate prices that the real estate industry wasn't blamed for the last bubble so much. Mortgage brokers were for shady mortgage deals, but not so much the industry. But that's been the history of things, is to blame the companies for the rising prices. I noticed today that the government is thinking about suing Google for under the antitrust laws. So that could very well be the first example of this phenomenon of the government going after big, highly visible companies to blame them for rising prices, even though, internet search is not exactly, really taking money out of my pocket, but that's what they're doing. Christina Hines has a lengthy question here. Could you summarize the question as far as that goes? I'm not logged into the Mises Academy forum. I believe in Occam's razor, so if you have a long question, surely you can make it shorter in some way or break it up into several questions. Of course, I guess I'd recommend another reading. I would recommend Power and Market by Rothbard. Read what he has to say about antitrust and monopoly there, in addition to Man, Economy, and State. But Power and Market is also very good. She's not logged in. Oh, no. Well, I'll read her questions later, and then email. I'll get back to everybody on the forum, and I'll answer her question on the forum. So if anybody else has a question, I'll sit around here. Let's see, Chris Banco's laughing out loud. So we have on the political strategy, the best strategy to repeal Sherman. Well, during the 1980s, antitrust was almost effectively repealed, not by law, but some of the Reagan appointees, the head of the Federal Trade Commission was a man named James C. Miller, and he was a Chicago School economist, trained at the University of Virginia, but his thinking was Chicago School. And as the head of the Federal Trade Commission, he let all just about every planned merger go ahead. In fact, he filed lawsuits against city governments for such things as taxicab licensing regulation, which really was creating monopoly power in the taxi industry. But the Supreme Court came by and said, you can't do that. You can't sue City Hall, literally. And so the real monopoly that was out there through occupational licensing, the government's courts said, can't touch that. That's a government monopoly. We like government monopolies. And so he wasn't able to do that. So he did some pretty good things. He was enabled to do those things by essentially 30 years of research criticizing antitrust in the economics literature. And that's what he used as his justification for de facto abolition of antitrust laws by just not enforcing them very, very vigorously at all. And so there was no movement to establish legislation, but it sort of was de facto abolition. And then after that, by the time you get to Bush 1 and Clinton and Bush too, they resurrected antitrust, of course, with the Microsoft case was the biggest case, and then and plenty of others. So nowadays, now you see them, you know, Google wants to buy some small company, and the government is investigating Google as though they're going to monopolize the internet. Let's see. But I don't know if I have a strategy. I'm not a good political strategist. I do know that the reason why I have, and typically the kind of research I do is I try to strike at the root of these things. That's why, you know, I'm familiar with all this vast literature of criticisms of antitrust, but I'm known for looking, publishing several articles on the origins of antitrust, arguing that it was rotten and corrupt from the very beginning and therefore should be abolished. And I think that's what has to be done, and that viewpoint has to be accepted, that reform will never work, that it's inherent that there's a conflict between real competition and antitrust regulation. And at least, you know, we have to get a critical mass of politicians, unfortunately, to come to agree to that. It happened before with, you know, with James C. Miller. He did some good things for several years, and then we slid backwards after he was gone. But that's the best we've done in my lifetime as far as trimming back antitrust. Christina asks, what are my thoughts on the antitrust complaint Microsoft filed against Google with the European Commission? Well, this is this is what happens when business people like Bill Gates and others at Microsoft are uneducated in economics or in particular political economy. You know, Gates was victimized for over a decade by the antitrust thugs in the U.S. He should have learned better. He should have known better. So now he's learned to play the game. They victimized him also because he wasn't playing the game. He did not even have a lobbying office in Washington, D.C., and the Washington establishment was outraged by that. It was, you know, one of the biggest and most successful companies in America, and they were not giving, he was not giving Washington, D.C. its take. The Washington, D.C. is essentially like the mafia in that regard. If you've seen all, you know, any movie about the mafia on television, you see the guys going door-to-door in the neighborhood, telling all the merchants, if you want to do business in this neighborhood, you have to pay me protection money or else. That's essentially what Washington, D.C. was doing with Bill Gates and Microsoft. They were saying, you have to pay us, not protection money, but you have to finance our political careers if you think you're going to continue to do business in America without us harassing you and possibly destroying your business. That's essentially what happened to Bill Gates. And so he turns around, they finally brought a lawsuit against his company. Not much came of it when all the dust was settled. And so he turns around and starts playing the same game. He did open up his lobbying office. They taught him a lesson. They taught him a lesson. If you want to be in business in America, if you're real successful, you got to play the political game. You got to give us our share, us being the politicians. That's what he's doing. And that's the system we live under. Just last night, I sponsored a lecture at my university by the editor of the economics editor of Barron's magazine, Gene Epstein, who's a good, solid Austrian school economist. And one of the theme of his talk was the failures of capitalism. He combines crony capitalism into one word, capitalism, and that's what Bill Gates is practicing, is capitalism. Crony capitalism. He's trying to establish relationships with governments and then using those relationships to sue his competitors. That's the whole history of antitrust. And so it's too bad. There are a few principled and educated business people. I can think of one who sounds a lot better. His name is TJ Rogers. He's the founder of a Silicon Valley chip firm. And he's been written about in the business magazines for many years. And he sounds like a real solid free market guy who would not do this. John Allison, who's the CEO of BB&T Bank in the U.S., he's also a pretty solid free market guy, although none of these people are purists. But I doubt that he would ever do something like that because he's educated himself in economics and free market economics. But Bill Gates hasn't. And so it's too bad. Yeah, that's exactly right. What Christina is asking about is that many of these antitrust cases, that's the first thing that came to my mind when I saw that they were trying to sue Google, is that they're going to force Google to divert many millions of dollars and many, many thousands of man hours, as they're called, to defending themselves in court rather than developing their business. And that's the purpose. That was the purpose of the Microsoft antitrust suit. I think I probably mentioned this before. In my book, How Capitalism Saved America, I cite a book in the discussion of Microsoft in that book, in my book. There's a book by John Heilemann called Pride Before the Fall about the Microsoft case. And he explains in great detail how the whole thing was concocted by Microsoft's rivals who teamed up with Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah. And then the Novell Corporation is headquartered in Utah. So Novell got Orrin Hatch, the senator, to use his power as a United States senator to go after their competitor, Microsoft. And whenever you have one company going after another company, you know that the aggressor there is doing something that is not good for the consumer. Because if Microsoft really was raising prices, as monopolies are said to do, Novell would have been happy as could be, because they could either then raise their prices or not raise their prices and take huge market share from Microsoft. But Microsoft was dropping its prices and offering better quality products. That's why they had to be stopped. And that's why Novell and these other competitors got Senator Orrin Hatch to launch the Microsoft investigation, which after a number of years turned into the antitrust case against Microsoft. Let's see. Can exclusively owned resources be regarded as sufficient condition? Well, I think the flaw in that argument, exclusively owned resources, is it implicitly assumes that there's some lump of resources out there that is known to everyone. If you're talking about a natural resource, that's never been true. Whenever any resource becomes, the price goes up for whatever reason, becomes more scarce, for example, that provides incentives for entrepreneurs to discover more sources of that resource and to discover substitutes for that resource. And it also gives consumers an incentive to search for substitutes and to use substitutes. And so the whole idea that you can have a natural resource monopoly is based on the implicit assumption that there is some known lump of that resource out there that is unchanging. And this is very atypical of Israel Kirzner, who after all is quite a Hayekian in his thinking about competition as an ongoing evolutionary process. And so so I would think that would be the difference between Rothbard and Kirzner talking about a resource that can be a monopoly. If someone corners the market for some natural resource, that's, I think, all of history of natural resource markets disproves that. Why does the notion Mises-Kirzner view exist if they disagree on monopoly definition? Well, it depends on who uses the Mises-Kirzner view. I guess anybody can say anything. I don't use that language, so you'll have to ask whoever uses that language why they use it, but I don't. Is the fairness doctrine an antitrust attempt at regulation? I guess you could call it an antitrust. You know, it's not aimed at trusts, of course, but yeah, it seems to me to be an antitrust attempt at regulation, the fairness doctrine. You know, behind all these antitrust cases that I've mentioned is the idea of egalitarianism. It's all these judges and politicians and lawyers who said all these things condemning efficiency. Well, that's pretty much the same as, if you look at it on an individual basis of condemning the rich as being too rich and not really concerning yourself with how they became rich. Did the man who owns the dry cleaning establishment in your neighborhood, who has gotten himself out of bed at 4:30 every morning and worked until 10 or 11 o'clock at night every night for 35 or 40 years, and he has $5 million in the bank, who cares how he got rich? He's rich and he deserves to be taxed in the name of equality and punished by the government because he's rich. It's the same idea with antitrust. The company, the entrepreneur who does the same thing, gets up early, spends long days, works hard his whole life, takes risks, invests his money, goes deep in the debt that could ruin him if his business plan doesn't work out, and then he succeeds. We should break his company up in the name of equality because he's harmed the people who are not willing to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and work 14-hour days. And so they prefer to go to government and bribe the government to punish their rivals. It really is the egalitarianism that is behind the support for antitrust regulation, sort of business egalitarianism. And the so-called fairness doctrine is the same sort of thing. It doesn't recognize that there are many different types of information that people can get. For example, when they first brought this up in the context of forcing the radio stations that carry Rush Limbaugh to carry some left-wing fanatic, Mario Cuomo or someone like that, and give them equal time in the name of fairness. That assumes that it defines the market for that type of information, political information, let's call it, to be only the radio. Whereas, you can get plenty of information from The Nation magazine, from the all over the internet, the television is very left-wing, the news, and there are all kinds of substitutes and competitors for the Rush Limbaugh show, but they define the market very, very narrowly as radio talk shows, and then say, well, we need fairness. And it's mostly an attempt at censorship to drown out the voice of conservatives or the few libertarians who are talk show hosts also. Most of them are neoconservatives, it seems to me. But there are a few counterexamples like Mike Church, who's on XM Sirius, who's a very solid guy. He was at the Austrian Scholars Conference several weeks ago. So if you want to listen to some good libertarian-oriented radio, listen to the Mike Church show on XM Sirius. I think it's in a morning radio show. He's based in Louisiana. Let's see. Ooh, what do we have here? What was that Microsoft book? I don't know if I mentioned the Microsoft book, but the best book on Microsoft is one by one of the authors. It's called Winners, Losers, and Microsoft. Stan Liebowitz is the main author. The co-author escapes my memory for now. But Winners, Losers, and Microsoft, in my opinion, is the best book. Two superb free market economists wrote this book, analyzing Microsoft and all the issues related to Microsoft. If I were to recommend one book on the subject, that would certainly be it, Winners, Losers, and Microsoft. Yes, Greenspan was against antitrust at one time. There's a famous essay that he wrote in Ayn Rand's book, Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, in which he just eviscerates the whole idea of antitrust. In fact, in the article on Mises.org that I wrote to advertise this course, I quoted him. And here's, and I might as well read it since you asked about it. The world of antitrust is reminiscent of Alice's Wonderland. Everything seemingly is, yet apparently isn't, simultaneously. It is a world in which competition is lauded as the basic axiom and guiding principle, yet too much competition is condemned as, quote, cutthroat. It is a world in which actions designed to limit competition are branded as criminal when taken by businessmen, yet praised as enlightened when initiated by the government. It is a world in which the law is so vague that businessmen have no way of knowing whether specific actions will be declared illegal until they hear the judge's verdict after the fact. That was Alan Greenspan in 1962 in his essay entitled Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. The same book has an article by Alan Greenspan in defense of the gold standard. And at one time, at one of the hearings of the House Banking Committee, Ron Paul got a copy of this article from this 1962 book. And when Alan Greenspan was the Fed chairman, he presented it to Greenspan and said, "Do you still agree with what you wrote in this article?" And Greenspan said, "Yes." And Ron got Greenspan to autograph the article. And he said he still believed in what he said about the gold standard. And so, yeah, he was very solid at one time. Stephen wants to know, to what extent did Mises, Kirzner, and Rothbard agree? On what? I guess monopoly and antitrust. Kirzner was always careful to lay out, he did lay out the case that that antitrust can be inherently incompatible with competition, but he never really took political position. He never made normative statements too often, saying we should therefore abolish antitrust. He always tried to, at least my take on his writings, is to keep himself in the domain of sort of positive economics, of explaining what is, explaining how the economic world works, without saying, I'm a champion of the abolition of antitrust or the abolished Fed or anything like that. Whereas Rothbard never hesitated to do that, because Rothbard always brought in his natural rights perspective on these things in addition to economics. Mises was not a natural rights theorist either, and so he was just as harsh about this type of regulation though as Kirzner was. And so if I were to say one thing about the differences, is that Rothbard's emphasis on his analysis, including natural rights theory along with economic theory, made him different from Kirzner and Mises also on these things. He was never afraid to say that this is a violation of property rights, therefore we shouldn't allow it. It's an act of aggression. But the other two did not do that very often. Other question, antitrust complaint, Microsoft. Well, I already answered that about Google, the European Commission. It's same question. Oh, where are we here? I guess I lost the forum. I guess we're being cut off by the chief, by Danny. Yeah, it is 9:15. I guess there's another course that starts at 9:00. So I'm assuming that Danny is cutting us off, because my forum just, my chat just disappeared. And so, well, thank you all again for a great class then, for great questions rather. I wish I could continue some more. I'll check out the forum. If there's some more, I'll answer the questions on the forum. And have a great night. Take care.